I'm joined by long distance telephone with John Molyneux, who's calling us from Brittany this afternoon. John, how are you?
Well, it's this afternoon for you, but it's actually nearly this old fellow's bedtime, you know.
It's been really interesting talking with you and learning about your music. And today I thought we would talk a bit about the span of time that you were a part of the John Renbourn group over in England. Mm-hmm. You were living in England at that point in time?
No, nothing as simple as that.
Ah.
How it all happened was that back in 1960, I was at the university in Birmingham. And I was running the folk club. As I was quite keen on running the folk club and nobody else was, my conditions were that to run it, I'd do that if they'd let me choose whoever I wanted to come and play, which was great. So I chose, obviously, amongst others, I chose John Renbourn and Jackie to come along, and John on his own various occasions. And so we got to know each other. This is, you know, a very long time ago when I was about 19 years old. And John has an absolutely elephantine memory. And anyway, many, many, many years later, in 76, 77, something like that, John came to play in Brest, because in Brittany, which is right out in the very, very west of the Breton Peninsula, which is the very most western part of France. And John came to play there because my then wife had organized a concert or two for him. And he remembered that we'd known each other in England, because that had been a long time that we hadn't seen each other. And so we kept up that contact. And when about a year and a half, nearly 2 years later, I made a record in England, as we were passing by John's place, I said hello, and John said, could he come up to the studio? And he heard the record, and things went from there. But I was living in Brittany, and John was living in the West Country of England, down in Devon. Tony was living, the flute player was living much further up the country. Kesh, the tabla player, and Jackie were living in London, or the London area. So we were spread all over the place. It was quite complex to get practice sessions together, but we all read music, and so, you know, there were very intense, fairly short practice sessions, but we'd all exchanged the music beforehand anyway, you see.
Today there are bands who are on both sides of the ocean and
sure.
Send emails back and forth, sound files back and forth. It seems so
sure.
Easy now to carry something like that out. But does it seem like that was a gargantuan thing to have that much of a distance between the band all those years ago?
Yeah. No, it was much more complex then, because there was nothing like sound files. If you needed to send, as I say, luckily we could read, but for folks who couldn't read, it was just a matter of sending cassettes in those days.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Email, nobody had even imagined it, let alone invented it. Yeah.
So were you there at the beginning of the group, the John Renbourn group?
No, I wasn't. No, I replaced John's girlfriend.
Well,
the first lineup of the band was the same as with myself, only he had a very lovely violinist and singer called Susie Draheim, who's still, I believe, an active and excellent musician in America. They were going out together at the time. But when Susie came back to America, and so John was, I think, was looking for a fifth member of the group, and invited me in. So
the timing was right.
Oh yes, no, I was lucky. Yes, I was very, very happy. Of course, because they're all absolutely wonderful musicians, and I didn't know Kesh and Tony before, but I did know John and Jackie to some extent. Mm-hmm. So Jackie to some extent, and John quite well.
That's yeah. Jackie McShee and Tony Roberts.
Tony Roberts. Well, still in very good contact with Tony Roberts too.
That's wonderful.
He's still a wonderful musician, and then of course Jackie as well. Jackie she is Pentangle now. She was Jackie McShee's Pentangle. She's
correct.
The only original member. and she's carrying on very, very well too. Well, the only person who isn't, sadly, is Kesh, because Kesh died not a few months ago. And,
oh, really?
Yeah, no, that was getting on for a year ago, and that was a very very sad thing for us all, because he was a lovely person and a absolutely wonderful musician.
The mix of music when you entered the John Renbourn group, was that changing? Was that in a state of flux when you entered? I know John likes to weave in all kinds of different musical influences into his music.
How to put it? The group was called the John Renbourn Group, but there was a very democratic way of living the music within the group. I mean, it was a very good thing that it was called a John Renbourn Group, of course, because that gave us all the publicity we needed, that plus Jackie also being a very famous musician. But, however, the music was contributed by everybody. And, we all contributed pieces. And obviously, it was by mutual consent whether we did a piece or not. There was no sort of conscious desire to change in one direction or another. It was just, what do you folks think of this piece of music? And if everybody said, yep, then it was done. To give you an idea, which is an extremely rare condition, in that particular group, right from the very minute I joined the group, I'm not very good at talking about money and stuff, but John brought it up himself, and he said, well, we're five, and we split everything five ways. I didn't say you're joking, but I was thinking that, because, I mean, normally you'd expect in that sort of group that the players who are the well-known ones would may well get, the lion's share of whatever was going. John said, no, we get so much money for a gig, it's split absolutely five ways, and if one of us has got the gig, if one of us had arranged the gig, then it would be split six ways, and the sixth part would go to the person who'd arranged the gig. It just couldn't have been more even-handed than that,
Well, when you were in the group, you played several instruments, but one of those was the mountain dulcimer. Tell me, had they heard dulcimer music before? Had they were they open to having a dulcimer in the band?
No, the dulcimer was very early on known in England, and actually, I think England was actually one of the innovating countries for dulcimer. Obviously, the Appalachian dulcimer is an American instrument with European ancestors, but some of the modern generation of innovative playing actually came from England, not entirely, of course, but there were people like Roger Nicholson, who was an absolutely wonderful player. He was also a friend of mine, but I mean, John and Jackie, everybody would have heard him and heard of him. There were people like John Pierce, who, although he wasn't a virtuoso player, he was an extremely good teacher of the instrument and got thousands of people playing in England, and we're talking back in the early 70s and things. And there was even Brian Jones, who, as you know, played an electric dulcimer in the Rolling Stones.
That's right. It's amazing.
Yeah, and so the dulcimer was a well-known instrument. I mean, the dulcimer was going through a sort of popular phase, a mode, I suppose, in Europe from the early 70s onwards, and end of the 60s, early 70s. Yes, everybody would have known about the dulcimer, It just happened to be that that's an instrument that is natural for me to play. It just seems to suit my hands and the way I move my hands and the way I like to sit and everything else. So, and when John heard what I'd been doing on it, then, that intrigued him,
It's just really lovely. But you play a lot of other instruments as well.
Well, I'd say I play with them.
Okay.
I mean, to be quite honest, I mean, if somebody says, "What do you play an instrument well, and if so, what is it?" Then my reply would be, in my own very personal style, using the Appalachian dulcimer and various derivatives that I've made of it, that's where I do my best music with it. I absolutely love playing other instruments, of course, and one of them, well, I suppose I started out with, when I was a kiddie, like a lot of people, playing the piano, but I have absolutely no technical talent on a piano whatsoever. But it did help me get into music. But the most important thing of all was singing, in fact. When I was a kid, you know, singing was a very, very important part of my life. So I'd say, actually, that's the basis.
Did you have a musical family?
In a funny sort of way, yes. My mum was American, and she was born in, 1909, brought up in New York. Her story went that she had, as a young girl, as a teenager, sung in some operatic chorus in some of the big places in New York. But she married my father and left the States when she was 19, so that was the end of any stage of public activity in music. But she'd always did, you know, for the rest of her life, had a very pretty voice and would sing to her children. So that, I suppose, there was an atmosphere that music was a normal part of life from her point of view. My father had absolutely no known musical ability, but he actually was one of these people that did sing absolutely dreadfully. However, he did love music. Yeah, he'd listen to a lot of stuff, mostly classical. Yeah.
So when during the span of time that you were with the John Renbourn Group, there were two of their albums, two releases that you were involved in, The Enchanted Garden.
That's right, yes.
And Live in America. That was recorded in America? Oh, I guess that one makes sense.
Yes.
It was.
Very logical today. I know you've had a bit of rough health recently, but you're obviously recovering very well. Yeah.
I'm sharp.
No, that's right. It was made in several places, actually. We were on tour. And you'll have to look on the record sleeve yourself to know when it was, because I have no memory for dates.
Well, I've got that it was released in 1982.
Yeah, well, that sounds reasonable, yeah. But it was the most intense and tiring tour I've ever done in my life. We played, I think it was 15 days, and I think 13 or 14 of those days were back-to-back, and we took a plane or a very, very long drive every single day, got to the new place, checked in the hotel, went straight to the concert hall, did a sound check, which, as you know, for a five-piece band can be very, very long, and then we did two back-to-back concerts in the same evening because the organizer preferred smaller, say, 300 to 500-seater places to play to rather than the big place, so we did two every day rather than doing one really big one.
My goodness.
And so that was a fortnight of, you know, extraordinary energy spending, and at the end of it, we turned up in California, and this is where the recordings were done on, I don't know, 2, 3, 4 different nights, live in the concerts, and it was Mitch Greenhill who had organized this, and Mitch had got a good sound recording crew together that did a live recording of several concerts, and then did a cut and mix job afterwards. The result of which was this record, which was originally a double LP called Live in America, and it's now put out by several companies, actually, as far as I know, on the CD.
Yeah, luckily that it is, too. It would be terrible to lose some of this music. I'm so glad so much of the folk music has been transferred over onto CD. When you were in the band, and before and after that as well, what was the state of folk music in the UK? What kind of things were happening? What was the atmosphere?
Well, at the band time, I would not be able to tell you anymore because, as I said, I joined the band in, 78? And I was already out of the country then since 76, you see. So I actually have virtually zero experience of the UK since then, very, very little. So that I can't tell you about. I can tell you far more about the situation of traditional music in France, in fact.
Well, why don't you do that? What is the state? Well, what's going on over there right now?
What is it? I'll be precise about where I live. I live in Brittany, as I said at the beginning, is the very westernmost part of France. You fall off the end, and the next bar's in New York. And I suppose if Americans would have heard of one musician from here, it would be someone like Alan Stivell. But it is, I'm sure you know, a Celtic country and has tremendous emotional connection and traditional connection with Ireland, Scotland, Galicia, and various other countries in the Celtic movement. And when Stivell was at the height of his popularity in the late 70s, mid and late 70s, there was a huge renaissance of this music. And dances, singing, because it's very, very specific music to Brittany. And maybe some of your listeners won't know this, as I certainly didn't know before I lived here, that Brittany has one major language which is nothing, in no way related to French whatsoever, which is the Breton language. It's as different as Welsh is from English. It's as different as Iroquois is from English, you know.
Oh, really? No, I didn't ever know that.
Oh, right. Well,
that's
it is. It is a totally different language. You literally can't understand one word if you're English or French speaking. There is another somewhere between dialect and language called Gallo in Brittany, but it is a very French influenced language. But the Breton language is a unique language, and it is very closely related. This is for linguists. It's related to the Cornish language in the southwest of England. Which had totally died out and has been, in the last few tens of years, has been revived by scholars and great enthusiasts. It's the first cousin of the Welsh language, too. So in long-distant times, the Cornish person could understand Welsh and could understand Breton.
That's wonderful.
Yeah. So anyway, this music was really revived in... thanks to Stivell and quite a lot of other enthusiasts in the end of the 60s, early 70s. And when I came over here in 76, it was absolutely booming. And it is now actually healthier than ever. There are more really, really fine musicians here in Brittany than there ever have been. And also backed up by the most extraordinarily good instrument making, the quality of playing, singing, dancing, and everything else, and spreading it around, and, you know, teaching, and just the fact that people do get together to do it in a very natural way, and in these lovely night dances called festinoz, which night festivities, which are wonderful occasions because people of absolutely every age get together. You get a tiny kid dancing next to maybe the grandparent, and as their chain dances, everybody helps everybody else to learn and get on with it. And it's
it sounds wonderful.
Well, it is, and they're very specific. It's very region specific. You can go, you know, 20 miles, and the actual major local dance is not the same. And the number one instrument in Brittany is, of course, the voice.
Mm-hmm.
As well. A lot of the dances are actually animated by singers.
Yeah. And you have some very specific instruments like the bombard?
Yeah. The most famous Breton instrument is the couple of instruments, because they always play together, which is the bombard, which is like a very short oboe. It's about a foot long. It's an oboe. It's just about a foot long. And it's very often in B-flat, like the Scottish pipes. A lot of Celtic instruments are in B-flat. And it's accompanied by a bagpipe, which is the most high-pitched bagpipe that exists in the world called the Binucos. Binu means bagpipe in Breton, Binucos. And that's an octave higher than the bombard. So they do singing in reply. The first one to go, say, and on the last notes, the other one will pick up, and the first one, and so it's singing one to the other. It's called chant et discant, and the singers will do this, singing and counter-singing.
We would probably call that call and answer over here. And I love that aspect of the music where there's a phrase that's repeated between the two, like let's say the two sides or something like that. There's a phrase that's repeated and then they go on to the chorus or whatever. That's really special, and it's something that there are some aspects of that in traditional music and the mountain music over here as well.
Mm. Oh, sure. I mean, I'm sure the Bretons didn't invent it and not the only people to use it. Absolutely. Mm. Yeah. No, it's... And, of course, they do tend to be, most of the Breton dances, not all, but majority are chain dancers. And so you could have had, actually, at the beginning and at the end of the chain, one of each of the two musicians. So you'd have the canard at the front and the discanard at the end. And they could actually be quite close to each other because it could be a snaky chain. And, in fact, they... Sometimes when if the electricity goes down here, there's no sound system working or anything else, well, people will do this. The musicians will just get down amongst the dancers, and the dancers will join in singing the music while they're dancing.
Oh, that sounds wonderful. Even if the lights go out, that sounds wonderful. You just keep it going.
Yeah,
it you keep it going, whatever cost.
Yeah. So I would say that traditional music in Brittany is extremely healthy. It's financially not easy, but then it isn't easy anywhere in the world at the moment.
But, that's very true.
The quality and quantity it's never been better. Yeah.
So I'm speaking right now to John Molyneux, who's calling us from Brittany and in France. And so how busy are you playing at folk festivals and you teach as well?
I teach very little because, what I do with any sort of competence is dulcimer playing, and it is unfortunately completely out of mode at the moment, and so that's something I don't teach. But mind you, the other day, the wife of a local musician who used to be a member of the Battlefield Band, a wonderful musician called Jamie McMenemy.
I was going to say. Yeah.
Jamie, yes. I was with Jamie and his wife Isabel the other day, and Isabel has just decided to learn the dulcimer in the last few months, and she's making a tremendous, tremendous effort, and she's really good. And so, you know, I'll sort of chip in and see if there's any way I can help her. And so, but however, you know, I wouldn't call that teaching. That's just playing with a friend. But no, playing. Am I busy? As busy as I want to be. Yeah.
Oh, well, that's perfect then.
Yeah, because I've done a lot of touring in the past, been away a lot, everything else. I've been there, done it, and now I pick up stuff that I really enjoy doing, where people call me up and say, hey, you know, I haven't seen you for a long time. So, well, that's a good way of saying I'd like to come, so, yeah.
Oh, great. Well, let's go to the music of John Molyneux now, because I know you have a couple of albums. One, you've melded into a compilation now, and of your music, just you.
Indeed. Well, with mind you, the second one, well, even the first one did have some friends in on it, you know, so, yeah. Yes, it is. I suppose the first one, which I made in 78... I think, yeah, 78. And it was called Dulcimer, which is a bit of a wordplay on dulcimer, but it is supposed to be one of the etymologies of the name of the instrument anyway. But so Dulcimer was really a collection of the folk songs that I had been singing and loved the best for, you know, quite a few years before that, which I'd been playing and singing on with other instruments. And I had one or two folks sit in on that. My lady friend from previous years, a wonderful singer called Annie Power, who still sings wonderfully and lives in London. There was the guy in the studio, David Lord, sat in on a few on a few things as well. And on the second one, I had Dan Arbraz came along. He's a well-known Breton guitarist and singer, and he came and helped me with that. I got a absolutely fabulous tambourine player. He plays what he calls the tamburino atomico, the atomic tambourine. A fellow called Carlo Rizzo. He's absolutely the world champion, heavyweight champion tambourine player. Fabulous. There was a wonderful quartet of trumpets and bassoons, which, because I wrote a couple, like, a sort of fanfare thing. I was a little bit inspired by Fanfare for the Common Man, though, with no claims to being within several light years of that sort of standard. And there was a wonderful pianist called Jacques Dangean, who did some accompanying as well. You know, quite a few people in there as well. Yeah.
And then there was a second album called Spice of Life.
Yes, that's the one I was just talking about.
Oh, that was that, okay.
On it. That's it. Yeah, Spice of Life. Well, you're right. They were turned in a few years back. They were turned into a compilation, but the guy who put it out has been rather inactive, staying polite. So I'm at the very present time thinking about the fact that I should really reissue them, and I think I shall reissue them as separate records, because a compilation does knock out a few pieces. So I think I might, as I happen to have the studio, well, I've got the master, they've been remastered, and I've got the rights on them. So I'm thinking of putting them out as the two original full records, in fact, on CD. Yeah.
I think you should. It's wonderful music. It's just beautiful.
Thank you.
And one thing before I let you go, because there are a lot of dulcimer players in this area, I always say you can't throw a rock without hitting a dulcimer player in this part of Ohio.
Well, don't throw rocks in my direction.
But they're going to want to hear about your dulcichord. This is something that you have created, and nobody else has one of these. Explain that for us, please.
Well, I've got several instruments nobody else has one of. Because I've got the very great luck to be an instrument maker and a player. Somebody like you probably know Doug Birch.
Oh yeah.
Well, Doug is a very dear friend. He's also a fabulous musician and a very, very good instrument maker. So like him, when you play an instrument and suddenly it really can't do what you want it to do, and you're dreaming of a sound. If you have the luck of being an instrument maker, in my case, I'd been through violin making school, then you can make yourself the sound you're dreaming about. So as I went to the dulcimer, not because I was madly in love with the dulcimer, but because I could actually play it. As I said at the beginning of the program, that I didn't come through any sort of dulcimer tradition. But I came across the fact that the position of sitting with it across my knees, that pianistic position of my hands over the strings, but playing directly onto the strings, the plucking, which I'd already done on guitar and mandolin and things, and even later on when I had an electric version with pedals, that actually brought in my childhood learning of the church organ. It all sort of fell into place. So these special versions came about because, you dream up a sound, and if you can, you make the instrument to go along with it. So the dulcichord is, as the name implies, a mixture of harpsichord and dulcimer. Because I was a bit frustrated by the lack of strings, but also by the lack of volume and tone color changes. Not that I wanted to replace the dulcimer, but I wanted other sounds as well. And so I made this thing using, it's a sort of a table, a sound table on four legs, really. It doesn't have a closed sound box. It uses the harpsichord technique of having an extremely light sound table and the strings pressing on it very, very little. The strings go over the bridge more with lateral tension than they do with vertical tension, so you can have an extremely light table, which is extremely sensitive, and with very lightly strung, with very light strings, you can still have an enormous volume and color range, as good harpsichords do. So that was one of them anyway. And another one which is unique to me is a five-string electric dulcimer, because, again, using the five DADAD, you know, going across open strung two octaves, I wanted a whole lot of other sounds. So I went to see a microphone maker, a fellow who sadly died, called Michel Benedetti. But he made, during his lifetime, some of the very best, they're electric guitar-style mics. He made some of the best pickups that were ever made. I know Frank Zappa personally went to his house to pick his up. You know, they were that good. And Michel made me a whole set of them. And so I made myself and also we put a MIDI system on it as well, which I don't use much, but it's useful for studio work. So that's a unique instrument too. I made one for Barbara Truex. I made her a four-string electric dulcimer, but without the MIDI, because she plays some very, very nice jazzy music on, you know, I don't know if you know Barb.
Not personally, no. I know of her.
You know of her, yeah. Uh-huh. Well, good. I mean, she's a lovely musician, lovely person, and she has one of mine, but otherwise it's, you know, it's just me.
Well, it sounds like you you're such an innovator that you're striving for and not unusual for people who make instruments to strive for something and they just go out and build it. That's just really amazing.
Yeah, well, as I say, I don't know if you've done a program with Doug, but you certainly should, because I mean he's, you know, we're talking the same language, you know.
I'm sure you are. Yeah, he does the same kind of thing.
He's wonderful. Yeah,
and that's where I found out you had a Facebook page when I saw you answer something on his page, and I went, "Wait a minute!"
Yeah,
and I'm so glad I did.
And I have met other, you know, wonderful American players when I've been over on tour. So one of my very, very favorites, both as a person and as a musician, is Lorena Lee. She's an absolutely gorgeous player, and say Barb, and all the roof, the whole, you know, several folks haven't heard for many years now, unfortunately. But anyway, I'd love to get back to the States.
You should.
But,
you really should.
And this is a serious but. How in heaven's name do I get to the States and go around the States with my necessarily, with necessarily several instruments, one of which, the dulcichord, is really quite cumbersome. It's, what, about 1.30 meters long? What, 4 feet? It's about 4 feet long.
Wow.
Its box is about about 18 inches by 4 feet by nearly a foot. And it's extremely fragile. There's no way that can go down into the hold. I need a fiddle. Well, I could borrow a fiddle in the States, but the dulcimer, the electric dulcimer, has got to come with me. And even my acoustic dulcimer, it doesn't have the same fretting pattern.
So I
just got to have four instruments with me. So how in heaven's name can I go to the States and get around?
Well, I think there's probably a lot of people who might lend you some dulcimers as well. But the fretting pattern would be a problem for sure.
Yeah, it would. I know, but I mean, they're my setup, they're my sound, and, you know.
Yeah.
So, no. The only thing I can think of is coming to the States and building an instrument, but then that would only restrict me to playing in a fairly small area, because, you know, once you're talking about airplanes, I don't see how I can do it.
Yeah, it's the flying. The flying is the big bugaboo. The traveling by rental car you could do without a problem, but
sure.
But the flying, yeah, and they're getting worse than they used to be.
Even the Transat would be. I don't know how I'd have to find an orchestra or somebody I could stick my instruments in their huge flight, you know, cargo container or something. Because I just don't know how to safely bring my instruments, because I really can't travel without 3 to 4 instruments, and they've got to be mine.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so
I have heard recently that this, maybe, I don't know how many of the airlines over here have changed their guidelines toward musicians and instruments. And but whether that will be across the board followed by, you know, the various areas, I have no idea. But it's been something that we've been lobbying for over here for a while, to not have everything stuck in the hole, that we sometimes were promised, oh, they're going to go in a special place on, you know, up above on the plane, and then it doesn't happen, and it's really hard to know how that's going to be implemented. But boy, you need to get over here.
I would love to. I absolutely would love to.
Yeah.
But there's no point. Like, well, I mean, I know people would lend me instruments, which is absolutely lovely of them. But then, you know, my instruments are a big part of why I'd come.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I can see. And you can even ship them ahead and be assured that they were going to arrive in one piece.
They'd have to be in something like an orchestra's container, you know, handled by people who are, you know, really specific to that that business, you know.
And what would it take to hook up with that? I have no clue.
I have no idea. Anyway, so this is, as the French would say, un cri de coeur, a cry from the heart. So you dear folks out there who are listening to this program, please give Cindy all the ideas you can about this, because I would love to get back. I'd absolutely love to play in the place, and not only for the music, but for the friends and those that I'd meet. I'd absolutely love to come.
Oh, it would be wonderful to see you over here, for sure.
It's something you didn't say, by the way, but of course everybody out there will have understood this by my typical accent, is, of course, I am American.
Oh, you sound you sound terribly American.
I am American, yeah. Yes, well, what I told a customs man this once, he said, hey, tell me, sir, where are you from? I said, oh, California, old chap. And he just went, oh, you're kidding. I said, well, no, look at the passport. He said, oh, my God.
Well, John, it's about time for me to call a halt to this. I don't want to keep you on the phone. It is your bedtime. But
What is,
I mean, you want to come back over here. I really think that would be great. But what else is in the offing for John Molyneux? What else are you, is there music that you're working on? What else are you thinking?
Well, I do a lot of storytelling as well.
Oh, that's right. I forgot about that.
Yeah, not kiddie stuff. Well, I mean, it's for any age. I mean, there's nothing, obscene or violent in it. But it is for. There's a big European movement of telling stories, so I do a lot of that as well. And sometimes I mix them up with music as well. So I do quite a lot of that plus music. Yeah. I'm trying to learn a few new songs at the moment, and keeping my playing up to scratch and that sort of thing. And I'm also doing my scales on my new horse.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, I got this lovely new horse called Peccadillo, if you like. And she's quite an interesting character, so I'm learning my scales on her at the moment as well.
So what is life like in Brittany? Just everyday, day-to-day life. Are you out in the country?
Yes, absolutely. No, in a tiny little hamlet, and when I say tiny, I mean 11 houses, four of which are lived in regularly. But the distances aren't great, and the roads are extremely good in Brittany. So it's a very friendly country. We deliberately choose to live here. Although there might be better weather in other bits of France, this is, socially and artistically speaking, one of the finest places one could hope to live. And it's also very beautiful too, because we live right out in the country. If you look on the map, you look at the last big district of Brittany, the very most western part of the end of the peninsula, that's called Finisterre, which means the end of the earth, of course. And Finisterre, in the middle of Finisterre, there's a range of hills called the Mont d'Arrée, the Arrée Mountains, and we live on the southern foot of the Arrée Mountains. But they're we're only talking about 1,200 feet, something like that, you know.
Oh, wonderful. It sounds absolutely wonderful. Well, John, I'm going to point people toward your website in case they would like to go and find out more about
you. Website, but if folks want to contact me, they can do it through the website. They're very welcome, and I'd absolutely love it. If you have any feedback from the folks who listen to your program, and I absolutely love to hear that, and I'd be very happy to enter into contact with players and exchange music as well. And because, as you said, now we have the web, we have emails, we have Skype, we have all these great tools for getting people together as well. So.
And that website is Molyneux, John Molyneux, spelled Molineux.
If you put my name up, it's the first thing on Google.
Oh, super.
Yeah, that's all you have to do. Just put John Molyneux and there it is.
Okay, that's easy to find then. Well, John, as always, it was just really a pleasure talking to you.
Well, Cindy, I'm very, very happy to talk to you as well. And you folks listening, I hope we have contact. And take good care of yourselves and enjoy your music.
Thanks, John. Oh, that was brill. That was brilliant. I think we went a bit over, so I'm going to have a lot.
You do some cutting in there, yeah?
Oh, yeah. I love to edit, and I will be editing. And I think I just may throw a few snippets up on the Dulcimer radio station as well. Just you talking about making some instruments or whatever, I think I may throw those in there the next time. I don't usually do interviews on there. I just play music, but I think it would be fun. So I may do that as well.
Yeah. And anyway, if there's feedback, I mean, if you want to do a few – you know, now and again, little sort of follow-up chats. If you want to have a sort of, any sort of follow-up, that'll be fun. Yeah.
I enjoy talking to you. You're just great. And
likewise.
Yeah. Well, I try, but you are. That's just really special. Well, okay. Go back to bed or go to bed.
Actually, to be quite honest with you, I've got to Skype another American musician in a few minutes' time. Have you heard of an absolutely fabulous Celtic harpist called Anne Heyman?
Oh, yes.
Well, I'm going to be Skyping Anne in 10 minutes.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, that's going to be something.
She's a good friend, and she is just the best.
Yeah, she is. Remember stories about when she showed up at Robin Morton's door and Allison Kinnaird's door? And she just sort of showed up one day, and they're going. She says, "I'm a harpist," and an album came out of that actually. So, that's really wonderful.
She is absolutely my very favorite harpist. Yeah.
Oh well, that's special. Well, I don't want you to miss her. Thank you
much. No, we won't. And she's also got the wonderful talent of being. She was a professional standard horsewoman as well.
Oh my gosh.
Oh yes.
Oh, so on so many levels, you're going to talk about your horse to her too, I'm sure.
Well, actually, you won't believe this. She's looking for a horse's skin.
Oh my God! Really?
To make a very early form of harp with.
Oh, whoa!
Yeah. So this is that's probably not for radio news.
It's this is all not going to go anywhere. But
no, that's probably a private project which you'll talk about later. I think.
Oh wow!
But,
That's interesting. Well, I'm so glad. Okay. It's been a blessing talking to you.
Take care of yourself.
I will, now that I'm almost well. And thank you and bless your heart.
Well, you do. And do please keep in touch.
I will, and you as well. Facebook is our way.
That's it.
Thanks, John. You take care.
Bye-bye, Cindy.
Bye.